From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Obamacare, the battle continues. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president's re-election has set off a scramble for states that were waiting in case Mitt Romney would try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But it's still the law of the land, and states have only till this Friday to decide if they'll set up exchanges where 30 million Americans can buy subsidized health insurance. About one-third of the states have already said no, meaning the federal government will step in. Meantime, crowds of special interest are demanding change. What about the impact on Medicare and Medicaid and the rising cost of medical treatments? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the re-elected president faces the White House press corps. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. In the aftermath of the president's re-election, states, hospitals, and insurance companies are now faced with fully implementing the Affordable Care Act. How deeply rooted is the continued opposition? What are the prospects for affordable coverage for 30 million uninsured Americans? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll catch up with President Obama's first full-scale news conference in many months. He'll talk about the fiscal cliff, the Petraeus scandal, and immigration reform. First is news update. After days of missile and rocket fire from Gaza, Israel escalated the confrontation today with multiple airstrikes and the targeted killing of Mahmoud Ahmad al-Jabari, a senior military leader of Hamas. Hamas, the elected Gaza government, reacted in fury, calling it the basis for a declaration of war. Dan Efron is in Tel Aviv for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren.
How concerned are Israelis about the prospect of retaliation now that the Hamas is thought to have missiles and rockets that can reach 25 miles into Israel?
Well, I'd say pretty concerned. I think mainly in areas that have not been targeted in the past by Hamas. In other words, if you look at the last few months, the concentration of rocket attacks from Gaza have been around the Gaza Strip, at small Israeli communities a few miles out. But what the security officials here in Israel are saying now is that they have new types of missiles or rockets that can reach as far as Tel Aviv, really maybe 40 miles, that kind of range. And so even in Tel Aviv, where I am now, there is some sense of foreboding, some sense that maybe there might be an attack during the night or sometime during the course of this operation.
Does it appear that Prime Minister Netanyahu got in touch with President Obama looking for approval of a before making this onslaught?
I'm not sure he did, and I don't think he would seek approval. I think that's the kind of thing where if you ask for approval, you risk getting a no on the other side of the phone. I think diplomatically, there's probably some way of letting the White House know, either through the ambassador in Washington or through some other channel, that this is what Israel is about to embark on. And, you know, the Israeli line is that Israel has been suffering from rocket attacks over a very long period of time, but really a concentration of them over the weekend. You know, that Israel retains its right to respond and to try to change the equation between itself and Hamas in Gaza.
Did Israel suffer casualties as a result of these concentrated attacks?
No casualties, certainly no fatalities. Let's say I think there might have been some people who were lightly wounded. And that's been generally the nature of the rocket attacks. They're pretty primitive rockets, at least the ones that Hamas has used so far or uses commonly. They tend to fall in open fields. There are, you know, occasions where they fall on homes and don't necessarily penetrate. Having said that, they do create an atmosphere of terror, of fear, and I think that's, you know, that's the point. And so there are whole periods, days or weekends, when residents of that area, residents of the south in Israel, are either living in bomb shelters or staying close to shelters and feeling the sense of fear.
Does Mr. Netanyahu have somewhat limited options because of a lack of international support?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think he's got limited options compared to even just a few years ago when Israel launched a very aggressive campaign in Gaza, Cast Lead. That was in 2008, so 4 years ago. You know, the situation in the region has changed. The Arab Spring has brought to places like Egypt governments that are more antagonistic towards Israel. In Washington, there's a U.S. president, it's no secret, whose relationship with Netanyahu is not very good. So I think Netanyahu can't quite rely on a reflexive support, a posture of support, either in Europe or in Washington or in the region, the way Israel could in the past. And I think that's a big factor. It's a constraint on Netanyahu.
You have mentioned Egypt. The current president is more friendly toward Hamas than his predecessor was. Does that make a difference?
It certainly does, although it's not. It's a little more nuanced than we would think. His position towards Hamas is, on the one hand, Hamas is an ally. You know, he is from the Muslim Brotherhood. The Egyptian leader is from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is really the kind of sister organization of Hamas, and they tend to see things eye to eye. But Egypt has its own interests and its own concerns, and Egypt doesn't like to see too much influence flowing out of Gaza, the influence of militancy, of extremism, out of Gaza and into the Sinai, into Egyptian territory. So, for instance, something that might seem counterintuitive, that border between Gaza and Egypt is often closed, or it's open very selectively to the passage of people and goods.
Very quickly, if you can, you've written about the kind of pressure that Likud and the conservative parties were putting on Prime Minister Netanyahu. How important is this to the upcoming elections there?
You know, it's very important. And from Netanyahu's perspective, he wants to look tough, but he certainly doesn't want this to get out of hand. And I think for that reason, we probably won't see a ground operation. We won't see even an air operation lasting very long, maybe a couple of days, but probably that's it.
Okay, Dan Efron, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, is speaking to us from Tel Aviv today. Thanks a lot, as always, for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, Obamacare. The battle continues on To The Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Ollie back with To The Point. During one of the debates with Mitt Romney, the president said he didn't mind the term Obamacare. He'd kind of gotten to like it. In any case, the Affordable Care Act is the biggest expansion of America's social safety net since 1965. It still faces challenges, but the president's re-election means that repeal is less likely than it was before. Meantime, the first of many deadlines for implementation comes the day after tomorrow. That's when states have to decide if they'll create so-called exchanges, new marketplaces, where some 30 million uninsured Americans eventually can buy subsidized coverage. Noam Levy is healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be with you.
Tell us about what's going on and how the states are reacting to this deadline of Friday. I understand a lot of them have already said they're not going along with this.
That's right. We've had a number of Republican-led states around the country come forward and report that they will not set up these insurance exchanges. I would say not a huge surprise which states these are. There are many of the same states that went to court to try to get the law thrown out. Although there was, I think, some expectation that at least some of these states would acknowledge that the law is likely to go forward now and implement it. That obviously is not the case.
They certainly don't have a lot of time to get ready if they decide that they do want to implement it. And the government, though, is not, as I understand it, relaxing this deadline.
No. What the Obama administration has done is tell states, if you want to create your own insurance exchange, these internet-based marketplaces where consumers will be able to shop for a health plan if they don't get one at work. If a state decides that they don't want to do it themselves, but maybe they want to partner with the federal government, they have a little more time, or if they want to develop a blueprint for doing this, they have a little more time to do that. But by Friday, they do have to alert the federal government whether they're going to do this themselves or not.
Now, what if they decide they don't want to do it? Then the federal government steps in?
That's right. The law authorizes the federal government to create the same insurance exchange in each state that doesn't do it itself. So there won't be a national exchange per se, but the federal government would run an exchange in Texas, an exchange in Alabama, an exchange in Kansas, in any state where the governor decided he didn't want to, or he or she didn't want to do it themselves.
When consumers have to make a decision themselves, will it look different if the federal government has set up the exchange as opposed to one state or another?
I suppose it could look a little bit different. Just be presumably a different website, and it might have different colors. I don't know. It would essentially be the same function. So I think, notwithstanding all of the focus on insurance exchanges, because those are sort of the next deadline that approaches us on the Affordable Care Act, I don't think for most consumers they're probably going to be able to tell much of a difference about whether their state is running this thing or whether the federal government is running it.
You said at the outset you mentioned that many of the states had gone to court. Obviously, they went to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to get Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act overturned. That didn't happen. But the court did give them an opportunity to opt out with regard to Medicaid expansion. Tell us about that and how important that is relative to what we're hearing about the exchanges.
Well, that's right. You remember, just by way of background here, that there's sort of two mechanisms that the Affordable Care Act relies on to expand coverage and guarantee coverage to all Americans for the first time. The one is this exchange that we talked about, which is designed to provide low and moderate income people with a option to purchase a private health plan that and qualify potentially for some subsidies. The other half of the equation is this Medicaid expansion. Now, Medicaid, created in 1965, was originally envisioned as a program that would provide health insurance for poor children. And it's been expanded in different states around the country to include mothers, some poor single people, although most states don't do that. So the big thing that the Affordable Care Act is, it says everybody who earns less than about 133% of the federal poverty level will now qualify for this government health plan. But what the Supreme Court said over the summer was the federal government can't force states to do this. And because every state runs its own Medicaid program, the state could elect not to expand its Medicaid program and keep it as it is. There is no option, similar option for the exchange. There will be exchanges everywhere. So this creates this situation, which I think is actually much more consequential than whether or not the federal government or state government will run an exchange. Because if a state says, I don't want to expand my Medicaid program, there's no mechanism for the federal government to step in and provide that additional level of coverage. So, for example, Texas decides that Texas doesn't want to expand its Medicaid program, there would be this somewhat odd situation starting in 2014 where people making above 133% of poverty, which is still relatively low income, anybody making more than that would qualify for guaranteed health coverage. But if you were a working, poor, middle-aged guy in Texas, you would not be guaranteed. You potentially would not be guaranteed health coverage in the state. So it sets up a potentially complicated and very consequential development in a number of these states.
Is there any way to estimate how many of the 30 million that the president's trying to cover wouldn't be covered if Medicaid weren't expanded by all the states? I suppose because you don't know which states are going to do it, it's very difficult to make an assessment like that.
It is. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office took a shot at this a few months ago after the Supreme Court issued its ruling, and I believe they estimated that a couple million fewer people would end up getting coverage, although it was an inherently impressionistic analysis, because CBO itself acknowledged that it couldn't guess at this point which states are going to do what. Just very briefly, a number of Republican governors who've been so hostile to this law have sort of said or hinted that they don't want to expand their Medicaid programs, but there is something of an expectation that at least some of these governors will be convinced that this is a pretty good deal for states, because the federal government's going to pick up 100% of the cost of this expansion, at least initially, and then dropping down to about 90%. And because hospitals and doctors in these states are presumably going to pressure state leaders to accept this, otherwise they will continue to be saddled with many, many patients who have no way to pay their bills. So there is an expectation that notwithstanding some of the rhetoric right now, that when push comes to shove, most states will ultimately come around and expand their programs.
Noam Levy, again, a health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. There still are those who think that the Affordable Care Act ought not to continue to be the law of the land. Jim Capretta is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, associate director of the White House Office of Management and Budget during the first George W. Bush administration. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What do you think states should be doing instead of setting up exchanges and expanding Medicaid?
Well, look, I mean, the president just got reelected, so it's not at all, you know, a possibility in the next 4 years for repeal of the law to happen. I fully admit that. I mean, that's a done deal. But I think the question is, can a different vision for health care emerge in some of the states? And that's still a possibility. The law does allow the administration to grant broad waivers to how one proceeds with reform at the state level. So states can resist doing it the way the law has sort of laid out as a template and pursue other kinds of reforms that would, I think in my judgment, lead to better outcomes both for the patients as well as the overall system. So it's a question of no reform, but how to do reform. And there's a lot of people, myself included, who believe that the healthcare law is centralizing too much authority and power at the federal level, and states should resist that as much as possible. And that includes not participating in the options that are provided to it.
So you think then that under the Affordable Care Act, they would have enough flexibility to do things on their own?
Well, the law does grant the executive, the administration, the authority to allow states to pursue alternative ways of pursuing reform. And some states, I think, could still put together programs to do that in the future. Also, it's important to realize that the law will only be up and running in 2014, 2015, and 2016. So future presidents and future Congresses could also make changes in how it works.
What sort of changes would you like to see?
Well, the American healthcare suffers from lack of cost discipline. That's the key question. How do you bring about more discipline in the system to keep costs under control? And there are really two answers to that question. One would be to push it much more toward governmental control through a regulatory apparatus, and I believe the healthcare law will push us in that direction in time. The alternative is to actually build a actual functioning marketplace. I know a lot of people think the exchanges are intended to do that. My own judgment is that the exchanges are really going to be the first step toward more federal control over the cost system. So, what you need is consumer engagement. That includes changing how the government subsidizes insurance through the employer system as well as through Medicare and Medicaid. So long as the federal government does, as it does today, subsidize more and more insurance at a higher and higher premium through those mechanisms, the cost inflation will continue on, and you're really the only alternative is to put a lid on it through some kind of cost control mechanism. This is what they're doing in Massachusetts. They enacted, as we all know, a program that is sort of a predecessor to the national program, and now about 4 years into it, going into its fifth year, the state is moving ahead to impose essentially what amounts to premium caps in the program to try to keep state costs under control as well as premiums under control. And that's going to lead eventually in time toward a much more regulated system. The same thing will play out nationally if we go down the road we're currently headed down.
Jim Capretta, once again, visiting now at the American Enterprise Institute. Jacob Hacker is director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies, and he's also professor of political science at Yale University. He's author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Jacob Hacker, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
What do you think of the prospects for more states, Republican and otherwise, to say, well, we will go along with this, particularly the increase in their expansion, I should say, of a Medicaid, because in that one, there really is free public money, federal money.
Yeah, I agree with Noam on this, that it's going to be very hard to turn down the Medicaid expansion. contained in the Affordable Care Act. And it's worth noting that the Supreme Court's decision doesn't apply to some areas of the Medicaid expansion. For example, the expansion of coverage to kids just above the poverty line. So it applies particularly to this group that is not well covered under existing Medicaid law in most states, namely the sort of near poor adults under the age of 65. And as Noam said, the coverage is very the federal match is essentially 100%, and it goes down. I think there has been a larger push on the part of many states to try to restructure Medicaid. That's not a real prospect in the near term. But I think that, you know, the politics of Medicare is going to continue to be one where there's a fight over, you know, over the extent to which the federal government can compel the states to expand their programs in a context of continuing budgetary pressure at the state level. Where I think the more interesting story is is with regard to the exchanges. If you remember, during the debate in the House of Representatives, a national exchange was envisioned, and then due to the way in which the Senate works with representation of with two senators per state, the push was very quickly to go to state exchanges. And the idea being there'd be a lot of diversity and flexibility, and the idea that Jim puts out that, you know, that some of the states with more conservative leanings would be able to innovate and produce market structures that follow that model, and we'd be able to see what works. And unfortunately, I think the progress so far has not suggested a lot of that the states are really pursuing a lot of innovative, diverse strategies. I mean, more than half of the states are either have said that they're not going to create state exchanges or are not doing anything at all. And so I think the with regard to the exchanges right now, it's very likely that we'll end up with the federal government basically creating these state exchanges. And that's obviously better from my standpoint than not having the exchanges at all. But it really goes, you know, it really kind of cuts against the original argument for having the states do this in the first place.
But you do agree with Jim Capretta, then, that it would head in that direction. Your difference is that you think that's a good idea. He doesn't.
Well, I think that it would be, my argument is that if we're going to have the federal government creating state exchanges, we probably should have just had a national exchange in the first place. That is, that there would be, where possible, support for regional insurance markets being managed and regulated by the federal government. You know, there are a lot of insurance markets across state lines. And it's worth noting, I mean, going back to this fundamental question that Jim brought up, which is cost control, it's worth noting that the states are not going to be particularly well equipped to control costs. I mean, I think that whether you pursue a more competitive strategy or one that relies on regulation, the federal government both could create larger markets of competition because insurers are very consolidated.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break. Later on in the program, we'll hear about the president's news conference today. He talked about a number of different things, including immigration reform and General Petraeus. Back in a moment.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To The Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Onley back with To The Point, talking today about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which is going into effect. The opportunity for repeal, certainly within the next 4 years, has pretty much gone away. There nonetheless remains a good deal of debate about it, and we're hearing about some of that today, about the exchanges, about the Medicaid expansion, and about cost control as well. Jacob Hacker, again, let me go return to you at Yale University. You again brought up the question of cost control. Why is it you think that it's more likely to happen under the Obamacare formula than it is if we don't have that?
Well, I think that the Obamacare formula certainly puts in place measures, particularly with regard to Medicare, that could move the market towards a more efficient structure and would contain costs. But I would just go back to the point I was making is only that the really fundamental problem at the state level for controlling costs is that both the insurance industry and providers are highly consolidated. So if you want to make those markets more competitive, or if you want to create more regulatory approaches that involve using the concentrated purchasing power of government, the federal government is often going to be in a better position to do that. That's why I think that, and why I've long argued that there should be some kind of public option, a Medicare-like plan that's provided within these exchanges. And it could be the same plan nationwide, and would allow people to have that choice. I just want to say one last thing about this, which I think is really important. You know, as we look forward and sort of worry about where the states are going and what will happen, I think it's, as Jim said up front, it's a remarkable fact that there's been two near-death experiences for the Affordable Care Act, for Obamacare, and it survived both of them. And so maybe we shouldn't be betting so much against it. This is a big development, the fact that we now are going to see the law move forward, and a lot of the states are going to have to change their calculus suddenly. And you know that whether they decide whether they, you know, right now they've been, a lot of them have been standing pat, kind of waiting to see if the Supreme Court or the election would save them from having to do this, whether they wanted to do it or not. And now they don't have that option. So I think a lot of the states will move forward, at least indicate that they'll move forward in the near future.
Jacob Hacker at Yale University, you mentioned the public option. Every time we do a program about Obamacare, we get messages from listeners who want to know whatever happened to the public option. Noam Levy, let me go back to you, the health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We heard Jim Capretta say there will be efforts to modify Obamacare as time goes on. Are there any efforts to reintroduce the idea of the public option anytime in the next couple of years?
Not really. I just don't think that's probably anything that anybody believes is realistic at the moment. I think it's going to be hard enough to make some of the technical adjustments to the law that many people believe are necessary. You know, as these exchanges get up and running and as regulations come out over the next few months dictating kind of what health plans ought to look like and what employers need to do and how employers calculate how many workers are required to do what, there's going to be an enormous amount of pressure to minimize the disruption that all these new regulations and requirements will put on the market, will put on insurers, will put on doctors, hospitals, employers, you name it. And I think that those concerns are going to be front and center if there can be any kind of a bipartisan agreement on tackling anything related to the Affordable Care Act. I think you're going to see it in that space rather than the public option, which you know, was just incredibly divisive politically during the debate. I don't know there's a lot of appetite for revisiting that, at least now, although, you know, that may change in the more
sure.
distant future.
Well, I just wanted to let our listeners know that we haven't forgotten about the public option. Jim Capretta, quickly, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, do you agree with Noam Levy that the bipartisan opportunities lie where he said they do?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how much bipartisan opportunities there are there at this point. It's not clear to me that the president really wants to revisit many aspects of the law before the subsidy structure gets up and running. You know, in the coming months, I think the big opportunity is the fact that there's a big fiscal debate going on, that there's a big budget debate underway. And clearly there, the president does want and probably does need some bipartisan cooperation to get some kind of a budget deal. And in that context, one could envision some aspects of the law being revisited, despite the president maybe being opposed to that. You know, that people might say we need to cut back on the size and scope of the subsidy structure, which is obviously quite expensive. If you're going to do a budget deal, maybe that's the first place to start. So I think there's some opportunity there, but it really would likely come from, you know, sort of Republican pressure to revisit some aspects of the law, maybe getting rid of the Independent Payment Advisory Board. There's some bipartisan interest in doing that. I think there is some possibilities for that as part of a larger budget framework.
Let me introduce Genevieve Kennedy. She is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. That's a nonpartisan policy research and educational organization looking at the social, economic, and governance problems that face the nation. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
What about getting people to sign up, individuals who might be listening to this program? How difficult is it going to be, presuming that these institutions are, in fact, put into effect, to get people to participate?
Well, we have experience in the last 2 decades, particularly on the front of covering more children, that suggests that streamlined enrollment practices that minimize documentation requirements and other kinds of barriers really can lead to high participation. We've seen uninsured rates fall for children over the last decade. largely because of gains in Medicaid participation in the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that's been buttressed by a focus on outreach, retention, and really making the enrollment processes work for folks. In the experience that we saw in Massachusetts, as you heard, which is a precursor health reform effort, we saw substantial gains among already eligible individuals. So the combination of the mandate and all the publicity around coverage and the changes to the enrollment processes seemed to combine to lead to higher take-up.
Jacob Hacker, I know you need to leave us very soon. Just interested in your take on what it'll take to get people to sign up. Will they know about it? The polls show that a lot of people are suspicious of government involvement in health care. That may not be true if they're too poor to afford insurance. But I'm just interested in your take on that whole area.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's true that Medicaid has done a better job of outreach, but also the growth in Medicaid enrollment is partly just a reflection of how terrible the economy has been and how many people have lost coverage through employment. I think there are two challenges that are going to have to be faced. One is this reaching people who kind of fall between Medicaid and the exchanges. And I think that one thing to note is that the exchanges are not going to be, I think, seen as principally governmental. These are, you know, online. Primarily, people are going to sign up online, as they do with the Massachusetts Connector. They're private plans. So it's really a question for those who are enrolling there, whether they become aware of it and whether or not the subsidies they receive are generous. And that's another point, which is just worth noting, and this came up a lot in the discussion of the requirement to have coverage, is that the subsidies are quite generous, as Jim was saying, but they extend only up to around 400% of the poverty level. For a lot of people who have, you know, moderate to higher incomes, insurance coverage is still very expensive, and we don't really know how many will avail themselves of these exchanges. You know, a last thing I would just say is it would be ironic if we had in the budget fight a revisiting, say, of the IPAB, the Independent Medicare Payment Advisory Board, only because these were measures that actually reduce the deficit over the long term and represent a real promise for controlling health care costs. So I'm hopeful that while there may be some consideration of Medicaid, Medicare, and subsidies under the Affordable Care Act in the coming budget debates, that people are going to recognize that the only way we're going to deal with our budget problems over the long term is to control health care costs, and those measures that are most promising for doing so, like IPAB, will be kept in place. I mean, that's, to my mind, the sort of double-edged sword here, that it's going to be very hard to argue against key elements of the Affordable Care Act that control long-term health spending in a context in which that's the big driver of the deficit. We learned that during the fight just recently, during the debates. It became clear that when Governor Romney was saying we're going to do away with the reductions in Medicare's cost growth, he was really actually increasing the long-term deficit. So that, I think that's going to be a tricky issue to negotiate in the budget fight.
Okay, a lot of tricky issues involved in all of this. Jacob Hacker, again, at Yale University, author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Thanks, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Back to Genevieve Kenny at the Urban Institute. What about the Medicaid expansion, and will many states be unable to afford it?
Well, I'm glad you came back to that. And before I address that, I just want to emphasize how critical the Medicaid expansion is to achieving the coverage gains that have been projected under the Affordable Care Act. Over half of the new coverage is through Medicaid when the law is fully implemented. And it's targeting the population with incomes below 138% of the poverty level, who have very high uninsured rates. Among adults, it's over 40%. And that uninsured rate grew over the last decade. The question about whether the states can or cannot afford it is, you know, inherently a fiscal issue, an accounting for what the new dollars the states would have to put on the table to cover these newly eligible groups. Counterbalancing that are the savings through reductions in local and state funding to hospitals that cover uncompensated care for the uninsured, that go to community mental health centers that provide mental health care to the uninsured. So there are real, real spending that's been going on for a long time to provide certain types of care on an episodic basis to the uninsured in this country. And so when you look at this, the math state by state, I think a pretty compelling case can be made that in many states they're actually in a position to save money if they do this. And another issue here raised is that the states are going to have to cover Medicaid for populations who have been eligible for Medicaid but have not participated, and they're not going to get the same amount of federal support for that. They're going to get a lower federal matching rate for that. But I think most people expect that those already eligible children and adults will participate whether the states expand or not. And the group that's really on the bubble, the population below 100% of the federal poverty level, there the federal coverage of the new costs are 100% for 3 years, and the lowest is 90% starting in 2020. So it's really, really heavily leveraged federal dollars. And I think the last point I'd make is that when you look at the access to care, we have to remember these are humans. So there are over 11 million of them, and they're young and they're old. They're a mix of races and ethnicities and different kinds of individuals. But in every state that we've looked at, they have substantially lower access to care than folks who have health insurance coverage, even when you look at low-income folks. So they're much less likely to get primary care, much more likely to have unmet health needs. And these problems have very real consequences for them and their families.
So do you see real risks for the state here?
I do. I don't see that states are going to have the wherewithal to attack this problem on their own without federal support. And I don't. And I look at the last 10 years and you see the uninsured rates going up in this group for adults. And I don't see any forces that would break that and reverse that course. So I don't see other policy options on the table, and I certainly don't see the states that are saying they're going to opt out as having the resources to do this on their own.
Genevieve Kenny, again, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to Jim Capretta at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, now visiting at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to Noam Levy with the Los Angeles Times, and our earlier guest, Jacob Hacker. Good to have all of you, and thanks for a good introduction into what we can look forward to as Obamacare comes into effect over the next few days, weeks, and months. President Obama's first full-scale news conference in months was held today. We're going to have some highlights in just a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @ToThePoint_KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Wide open meetings with the White House press corps were a casualty of President Obama's re-election campaign. Today's was the first since last March. What he wanted to talk about, probably no surprise, was taxes.
We should not hold the middle class hostage while we debate tax cuts for the wealthy. We should at least do what we agree on, and that's to keep middle class taxes low. And I'll bring everyone in to sign it right away so we can give folks some certainty before the holiday season.
Rachel Smolkin is White House editor for Politico. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And no surprise that the president wanted to bring that up, and the language he used was very much what we've heard over the last few weeks and months. What would you say was the major news that came out of the conference today?
the major news was his answer about Susan Rice, who, of course, has been under attack by some key Republicans, including Senators John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham, for her answers that she gave early on television about the Benghazi attack, suggesting that they were the result of a riot and not terrorism-related. She's said to be the favorite to take over as Secretary of State when Hillary Clinton leaves, and Republicans have jumped on that pretty quickly as making clear that she would have a difficult confirmation hearing ahead of her. The president took that on directly. He rebutted those attacks. He said clearly that if Senator McCain and Senator Graham want to go after someone, they should go after me. It was quite a strong quote. He said that.
Okay, let me just interrupt you for a moment because we can our listeners can hear exactly what the president himself did say. Susan Rice, of course, is now the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Once again, here's how he responded to this challenge from the Republicans, McCain and Graham.
If Senator McCain and Senator Graham and others want to go after somebody, they should go after me. And I'm happy to have that discussion with them. But for them to go after the UN ambassador, who had nothing to do with Benghazi, and was simply making a presentation based on intelligence that she had received, and to besmirch her reputation, is outrageous.
Back to Rachel Smolka, and that's pretty tough talk.
Very tough talk, that use of the word outrageous. This is, you know, a part of the press conference he talked about reaching out and being open to working with the other side. This was not that part of the press conference. Very strong language from the president. And we saw Senator Lindsey Graham respond to that immediately afterward. The press conference was just wrapping up when he put his own very toughly worded statement out, saying, "Mr. President, don't think for 1 minute I don't hold you ultimately responsible for Benghazi. I think you failed as commander-in-chief before, during, and after the attack." And he said, "I have no intention of promoting anyone who was up to their eyeballs in the Benghazi debacle." So we're seeing very strong language on this on both sides. Clearly, the president was going to come out today and get asked a lot of questions about Petraeus. Interestingly, the biggest news he made was about UN Ambassador Susan Rice.
Well, let's pursue that a bit. Excuse me. We heard the president say that the UN Ambassador Susan Rice had nothing to do with Benghazi, and she was just making a presentation of evidence that she had received from somebody else. We have Lindsey Graham saying she was in it up to her eyeballs. That's a long distance apart.
The president's point was that she had come out, and she came out on the Sunday shows at the request of the White House, and the White House's position has been that she wasn't in charge of the intelligence and that she didn't work in the State Department. She came out and basically was relaying the information that she has been given. That is not an acceptable answer in the eyes of Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. But more than specific questions about her involvement, the president taking on the overall issue of why are you attacking this person, the UN ambassador. Obviously, there are lots of questions surrounding this incident, but the president was saying that she's just not, that's not the right place to be setting their targets just because they can. I mean, he went on to say directly, apparently, because they thought she was an easy target, that that's why these attacks seem to be centering on her.
Well, now we go directly to the CIA and the question of its role in Benghazi and whether or not Susan Rice and others were trying to provide cover for the CIA. That leads, of course, into the issues about General Petraeus. But what do
exactly.
we know about that and what has been said about the real role of the CIA and whether Ambassador Rice wasn't just a part of the effort to provide cover, which under the law they're supposed to do?
General Petraeus, we now hear, will testify initially last week on Friday when he left. It sounded like Mike Morrell was going to be the person to testify. We're hearing today that General Petraeus will still testify, and that was something much wanted by lawmakers, Pete King saying he's really the one who's in position to know the answers to these questions about the intelligence on the ground, the intelligence that was received, the CIA's involvement for and and accountability for and responsibility for this incident. I mean, the president did not get pressed much on this point. It was one of several areas where the questioners that he picked, and you have to remember that the president and his team pick the reporters who will ask the questions, but this was one of several areas he really did not get pressed on in the news conference.
Well, he was, of course, asked about General Petraeus, former General
right.
Petraeus, and now the late director of the CIA, and whether there were any signs at all of threats to national security. Here's what he said.
I have no evidence at this point, from what I've seen, that classified information was disclosed that in any way would have had a negative impact on our national security. Obviously, there's an ongoing investigation. I don't want to comment on the specifics of the investigation.
So then Rachel Smolkin, he went on to say that Petraeus had, that the country owed a great debt to Petraeus. He was sorry to see him go. He felt this was a totally personal matter. Of course, there's also been a question as to whether there was classified information disclosed in emails, not just those between Petraeus and his biographer, Ms. Breadwell, but also between General Allen and the second woman involved in all of this, Jill Kelly. Was the president asked about that?
He was not asked. Again, this was an area where he was asked in general terms and not specific terms. So he did say there's no evidence at this point that he has seen that classified information was disclosed that would have, in his words, negatively impacted national security. He talked about the FBI having its own protocols in terms of how they proceed. So the president was asked these sort of timing questions. Should you have been told sooner? Should Congress have been told sooner? And he made the point that one of the challenges the FBI faces is that they're not supposed to allow anyone to meddle, in his words, in criminal investigations, and that has been the practice that has been followed. There are certain procedures to follow. So he made these general statements and also said generally that he thinks highly of the FBI, but really did not comment on the specific case and where procedures followed the way they should have been in this particular instance.
We certainly heard the emphasis in his voice just now. Now, though, I have no evidence at this point that there's been any classified information disclosed. It sounds as if there's a lot that he's not all that certain about.
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of not being certain, only in regard to the investigation not being wrapped up. And he did say, clearly, I am withholding judgment with regard to the process of the investigation, which is still going on. I mean, they're still looking into this. And it was right after that that he made the more general statement about having a lot of confidence in the FBI.
Also talked today a good deal about the possibility for immigration reform.
This has not historically been a partisan issue. We've had President Bush and John McCain and others who have supported comprehensive immigration reform in the past. So we need to seize the moment. And my expectation is that we get a bill introduced and we begin the process in Congress very soon after my inauguration.
So Rachel Smolkin, seize the moment. Those are strong words for any president. How do you think he defines the moment?
The moment is coming, I would say, right after the fiscal cliff. Hopefully, we either don't dive into it, or if we do, we quickly come out of that cliff, you know, use our rope ladder to come back up. And then I think immigration reform will be something that's looked at pretty quickly after that. This president owes his reelection in part to the huge support he got among Latino voters. I mean, the margins were just overwhelming. And there was a real recognition of that even the day after the election by many members of the Republican Party that they're at a particular moment where if they don't do something about their support among Latinos, it's going to be hard for them to win elections in the future, given the changing demographics in this country. Now, what exactly immigration reform ends up looking like is a much different question. You know, are they going to be able to pass comprehensive immigration reform? Will there be something more like the DREAM Act, you know, where we'll see a little bit more of a piecemeal effort that will allow the parties to say at least they got something done? Those are the big questions that are looming. But there does seem to be a real desire among both Democrats and many Republicans as well to do something on immigration reform in the near future.
Very quickly, just a few seconds left, but with regard to the fiscal cliff, we heard him talk about tax cuts for the wealthy. What about the idea of letting an agreement slip by the first of the year when the tax cuts go out of effect and spending cuts are supposed to take place? Was he asked about the possibility of doing that?
Something that I would have liked to hear much more about at the news conference. You know, some Democrats want to see the president allow us to go off the cliff or, you know, dive off the cliff, however you put it, under the theory that once tax rates have gone up and then lawmakers of both parties cut them, that will actually give everybody a little more flexibility.
Okay, but he didn't get a chance to hold forth on that.
He didn't go into much about diving off the fiscal cliff.
Okay. Rachel Smolkin, White House editor for Politico. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Program produced today by Caitlin Schamberg with Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.